I'd like for you to go ahead and turn over to Philippians chapter 2, and we'll be looking at this passage here in just a few minutes. Philippians chapter 2. For the past three Sundays, we have been exploring the idea of the gospel. And if you've been able to be here for each of those sermons, you'll recall that back at the very beginning, we talked about the good news found in the Old Testament. Now, while there is never a reference to the word gospel, we do find the idea of good news, the meaning of gospel, permeating the Old Testament. Seems like everywhere we're looking, there's the idea of good news. And when that's applied then to Israel, it's always, with the exception of one time, the idea of good news coming in the form of salvation. God is delivering them in some way. And then we followed that with the completed picture in the gospel. All of the promises, all of the prophecies that had been made are fulfilled in the coming of Jesus Christ. And so these writers are very clearly saying to us, you need to look and you need to see that everything that all of these men prophesied in the Old Testament, that's having its fulfillment in Jesus Christ. But as we noted last week, this is not just an intellectual study. That what all of this brings us to do is to obey the gospel. That we are to take what is given, and three times in the New Testament, the apostle writers talk about the obedience that we are to give to those things. Even as they talk about it in the negative, they say those who refuse to obey will face punishment for that. But looking at the positive aspect of it, those who obey will be in the right relationship with God. And so with all of that as our backdrop this morning, we want to bring this to a very personal level. While last week's again was personal in the fact that we all as individuals must obey the gospel, this morning I want us to understand that we continue looking at this in the idea of the gospel living in me. Now, with that being said, every lesson thus far on this series has begun with Romans chapter 1 and verse 16, where Paul says, I am not ashamed of the gospel. For it is the power of God to salvation for everyone. And so we looked at that in a number of ways, but the idea of the gospel is the vehicle of salvation. Now, with that passage in mind, let's add a second this morning. As we look in Philippians chapter 2, going to verse 12, the apostle Paul, who also wrote the other passage we just cited, says this, therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, so now not only in my presence, but much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. The same word. Whereas the apostle to the Romans said, I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power to salvation. Here to the Philippians, he says, work out your own salvation. Is that a contradiction? Is the apostle saying to one group that here salvation is from God, it's the power of God, and to another group he's saying, well, salvation is whatever you make of it? Well, the answer to that is no. There is no contradiction. And the apostle is not talking about something that we have the liberty just to do whatever we want to do. And so in the course of our lesson this morning, I want us to look at what this does mean. To understand that what the apostle is saying is that the gospel must live within us as we think about our walk with God. Now, as we begin this lesson, let's talk about the idea of worthiness. We look here in verse 12 once again, and it talks about the idea of working out your own salvation. And that's going to tie very much in with a passage from the first chapter of Philippians. If you look back just a page or so in your Bibles to chapter 1, verse 27, I believe this is where the thought begins that continues through the passage we just read. In chapter 1, verse 27, the apostle says, only let your manner of life be worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come and see you or am absent, I may hear of you that you are standing firm in one spirit with one mind, striving side by side for the faith in the gospel. Now, as we consider this passage, as we look at the idea where the apostle is talking about worthiness, what's he talking about? Is he saying that the person who is going to come to Christ is a worthy person? Answer that question. I want to go back to a slide from last week as we talked about obeying the gospel. And you'll recall that as we explored this idea, we talked about the faith and the belief that are necessary that bring us to the point of obedience. That being baptized, water baptism, immersion for the salvation of our soul. As we consider that, and as we think about this part of our journey here, the idea of belief and faith, where we're working our way toward obedience, would any of you say that you were worthy of what the Lord was providing at that point? That you were coming to Him and you could present your case and you could say, well, Lord, I have been a pretty decent person. I've done all of these good things, and so I am worthy of your salvation. None of us would say that. The entire point of our salvation is that we have messed up, that we have sinned, that we have violated the ways of God, and because of that, there is no hope for us except for the grace and the mercy of God. There is no worthiness that brings us to God. In fact, it's just the opposite. It is our unworthiness that brings us to Him. So as we consider that, and we think about all of the things that Jesus and the Father and the Spirit have done at our salvation, the union with Jesus, the justification, the reconciliation, the sanctification, the adoption, the regeneration, we understand that none of us are entitled to that. None of us should get that. That it's only because of His mercy that He provides it. So with that in mind, I believe we can all come to the conclusion, can't we, that as the apostle talks to the Philippians in chapter 1 here, and he talks about their worthiness, the manner of life worthy of the gospel of Christ, it is not talking about pre-conversion. It's not talking about the point before baptism or our baptism that saves us. What the apostle is talking about is what happens afterwards. The idea of letting our manner of life be worthy of what the Lord has provided. And so considering that, it's the idea that after my conversion, I'm allowing the gospel to live in me. I'm allowing all of these principles that I find within the Word of God now to change me in the direction that I need to go. And thus my seriousness toward my salvation is going to prove worth. How serious I am about this great gift that God has given me is going to say whether I'm living that life that's worthy. If I may, I'd like to illustrate this point with a story I heard on the news this past week. Seems that there was a young man who had been adopted out of Tanzania. An American couple had gone in. They had found this child in poverty. And with the blessing of the child's mother, they adopted this young man, they brought him back to the United States, and they've raised him. He's college age now. And while these parents were very happy to bring him back, they did not have the money to send him to college. Except, one of his grandparents, adopted grandparents, had died and had left one of these parents a beautiful antique Chinese screen. And it was one from a very valuable part of China's history, I suppose, because they were able to sell it. And they were able to take that money and they were able to provide a way to college for him. I want you to consider that for a minute in that young man. Was he worthy of that gift? Well, we would have to say no. He couldn't afford it. He couldn't go to college on his own. The only way that he could go was if someone provided the way for him. And so here were these parents. They sold this very valuable antique that most likely had sentimental value as well. And they said, "We are giving you the opportunity." Now, that young man is just starting college, but let's pretend for a minute. Let's say that about a year from now, we hear an update on this story. And we find that He has gone to college and he has turned it into a partying life. That he never studies. He's always on the go. He's always partying. He's got a GPA that's in the tank. He's on academic probation. And the college has said, we are kicking you out. Now, how many of us would go to that young man's defense and say, well, now wait a minute. There was a very valuable gift given to him, and he deserves that diploma no matter what he does. Doesn't matter if he doesn't go to school. It doesn't matter if he parties all day long. It doesn't matter if he never opens a book. He deserves that diploma. Would any of us make that argument? But yet, how many times, religiously, do we find people making the same argument about our salvation? That here is God who has given us a gift that we do not deserve. He has paid the price for us. But then we have folks saying, no matter how we live after that, we're going to get the gift. No matter what kind of life we live after that, God's going to save us. I would suggest to you, when you read your New Testament, that argument makes about as much sense as saying the young man in college deserves the diploma simply because someone paid the price. He has shown no worth. And if you and I allow our lives to go in an ungodly direction, we are showing no worth. Thus the apostle says in verse 27, let your manner of life be worthy of the gospel. And if I may, I'd like to show you this from a different translation, which I think gets the idea for us. When it says the only thing that matters is that you continue to live as good citizens in the manner worthy of the gospel of the Messiah. You see that? The idea is not that we're gaining citizenship, that's the gift. But how we live as citizens is going to show whether or not we're placing much worth in the gospel message. And therefore, what we must do is to live as citizens and behave accordingly. But now let's go back to the idea that we started with, this idea of working out our own salvation. What is the apostle telling us? Well, if we put it in more simple terms, it might simply be this, where the apostle is saying, just go get it done. Look at what you're working for. Look at what you want to be. Now go and do it. And that's the command that he's giving us when he tells us now in this post-conversion period, after we've been baptized for the forgiveness of our sins, received the gift of salvation that we could not get on our own, now we begin living as the Lord would direct and tell us to live. And that's allowing the gospel to work in me. And what the apostle is going to tell us is this, that we are now in a cooperative effort with God. If you look on to verse 13, it says, we're continuing the thought, for it is God who works in you both to will and to work for His good pleasure. In other words, what the Lord is saying here is you and I are a team. We're working on this salvation business together. I am providing what you need. I'm giving you strength. I'm showing you the way. But you got to show me something too. You've got to show me that you're serious about this. You've got to show me that you're worthy of this message by the way you live and by the way that you act. And thus we find in this cooperative effort with God that what we are doing is we are permitting Him to bring us to glory. We are compliant. We are voluntarily saying, we want you to make us into what we need to be. Now, how does that happen? If you look back to verse 12, if your translation is like mine, the very first word in it is the word therefore. And thus the apostle is saying, something has got to happen before you enter into this partnership. Before you begin working out your own salvation. And it's the passage that Scott read for us this morning, where the apostle is talking about the humility of Jesus Christ. And he's basically saying to the Philippians, as Jesus was humble, so you must be humble. Now, if I'm going to work out my own salvation, if I'm going to get it done, if I'm going to enter that partnership with God to accomplish this, it means I recognize who he is. Because though we are partners, we are not equal partners. It's not to say I'm going to give 50% and God's going to give 50%. What it's saying is we trust that God, in partnership, is going to provide the way for us. And thus, as I think about the gospel living in me, the only way that that can happen is if I completely remove my life of pride. It's the only way it'll take place. Because God is not going to partner with somebody who is saying, look at what I'm doing. Look at what I'm accomplishing. Look at the good that can be found in me. No, it's just the opposite. What he's looking for is the one who can say, look at the good God is doing in me. In the work that he's provided, look at what God is accomplishing for me. And I think that's a very strong warning for us, because many times we struggle with the idea of pride. Sometimes we're the kind of people who say, well, I've got the right answer to everything. I just need to get involved in everybody's business and I can solve their problems and I can give them the best answers. If we have that kind of attitude, it's going to be very hard for us to ever allow God to serve the place that He must serve in bringing us to the point that we can begin working out that salvation. And so, humility is essential for this. And let me add one more thing. I've got to realize that God is my sole partner in this venture. I love the way the Apostle Paul leads into this when he says again in verse 12, therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, so now not only in my presence, but much more in my absence. Why do you think he said that? What the Apostle is saying is, I don't want you doing this to please me. I don't want you doing this so that you are a Paul pleaser. You ever worked with somebody like that? And then if the boss turned his back, nothing was going on. Let the boss come back in the room, the guy jumps up, and he looks like he's hustling, getting everything done. Paul said, I want you doing this for me. I want you doing this because of your relationship with the Lord. And when we understand that, hypocrisy's out the window. I'm not going to do things so that I can keep the elders happy. I'm not going to do things to keep my spouse happy. I'm going to do things because of my relationship with the Lord. Because of who He is. And the fact that I want the gospel to live in me. And while others may see it, that doesn't matter a whole lot. Because my concern is pleasing that heavenly partner, the one who has provided the way. Well, let's take this now to a very specific idea. Because the apostle has given us instructions on how we work out our own salvation. As we look at this passage that he's given to us, he's told us the things that we must do, the qualities that we must put on, the way we must behave. And he says, first of all, as you do it with fear and trembling. When you read those passages, this passage, those words need to have the exact impact they would have in any other context. If you talk about fear and trembling, that's exactly what the apostle is talking about here, as we would read with most anything. So therefore, he's saying, you need to be somewhat scared about what you're doing. You need to approach it with a bit of trepidation for fear of messing up. I love the way Thayer's describes this. When the explanation of this passage is, it's used to describe the anxiety of one who distrusts his ability completely to meet all requirements, but religiously does his utmost to fulfill his duty. I think that's it. We look at this and we say, I can't do it. This is hard. This is serious stuff. But yet we say, with God's help, I am going to do the very best I can do at it. And though failure may come from time to time, I'm going to get back up and I'm going to keep on doing it. You know, things that we don't really fear, many times we don't do very well at them. We're in the last days of football season. And no matter what team you root for, I can guarantee you, you can think of a game where that team went in saying, we got this done. We've got it won before the first ball is ever thrown. You know the rest of the story. The other team's on fire, and the team that was supposed to have won didn't. Why? They didn't approach it with fear and trembling. They didn't approach it from the standpoint of, I've got to take this very seriously. And I want to tell us that if the gospel is going to live in us, it cannot be ignored or shirked. It cannot be approached from the standpoint of, well, religion is something I do on Sunday morning, and once I'm done with Sunday morning, I'm done for the week, and I can live like I want to. There's no fear in that. And as Psalm 2 would tell us, there's no approaching the Lord in trembling like that. No. When we work out our own salvation, it's with the idea that I realize just how big a job I've got to do. And I come before God trembling and begging His help in this work that I have to do. And when I do that, I can then develop that work ethic that I need. I want you to notice verse 13, because verse 12 is not the end of the sentence here. He says, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who works in you, both to will and to work for His good pleasure. The Philippians understood what that meant. Because if you look back to chapter 1 and verse 6, listen to what the apostle said way back here in the introductory section. He said, for I am sure of this, that he who began a good work in you will bring it to completion at the day of Jesus Christ. Here's the good news. That while we are working out our own salvation, we're not on our own. God says, I am working to make you into something. And so again, that theme begun in chapter 1 and verse 6 continues on here in verse 13 where the apostle says, for it is God who works in you. So let's think about that idea for a minute. If God is working in us, what's He doing? Well, there's a lot of answers to that question. But in the specific context of the passage, it says that God is working to produce something in us. And that production will be both a will and a will to work. You see, what God is doing as He molds us into a heavenly vessel is saying, I want you to see the purpose of what's going on here. I want you to understand what I'm doing. So that when you understand that and you develop that will, you'll then do the work necessary. What's one of the biggest problems that Christianity faces? I'm going to tell you what I think the number one problem is. It's just plain old apathy. The idea that we are so comfortable with what's going on that we just don't take spirituality too seriously. That's what God's trying to change. Because if He can create the will within us, then the work is going to follow. And I'm not going to hear an admonition about encouraging a brother and then go my way and do nothing about it. And if I've got that will to work, I'm not going to hear a sermon on teaching the lost and say, well, I sure hope those other Christians can get that done. Everything that I see commanded within the Word of God for Christians, I'm going to do. Why? Because God's work has created a will within me to do the work to carry out my salvation, to live a manner of life worthy of the gospel of Christ. And therefore, all of these things that He's telling me to do, in them, I'm going to be like the Corinthians when the apostle said to them, therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain. I think all of us must have the desire that when the day of our death comes, we want to collapse on the finish line, right? We don't want to have any energy left. Because we want to expend every ounce of that energy in service to our God. And the idea, well, God calls on me to do too much. God wants too much of me. God expects too much of me. Will just be anathema to us. Because we realize in this will to work that these things are making us more like God. Which perhaps brings us to the next of these admonitions of the apostle. And it's that we work out this salvation without grumbling or questioning. Now, I tell you, I like to quote this passage to my children. You know, do all things without grumbling. It's not why it's here. God is not giving, in this case, this prohibitive ban on grumbling, though we could find other places. Here, it's dealing with something very specific. It's dealing with Him. Don't grumble against the plan that I've given to you. Don't grumble against the things that I've called on you to do. You think about that with the command for hospitality, where the Apostle Peter says, show hospitality without grumbling. Same idea. Here God is saying, when I call on you to do these things, don't complain about them. When I tell you what needs to be done to work out your own salvation, don't question me about that. Remember, it's He who gave the gift. It's He who paid the price. And therefore, He has full right to say, this is my expectation of you. I hope that that young man's parents told him something on the first day of school. I hope they said, there was a very great price paid. Show us that you're worthy of it. Show us that you're going to become a scholar. Because God says, I have paid the price for your salvation. Show me that you believe it's valuable. Show me that you're going to become like me. And in that, I don't question Him. And in that, I don't complain. And all the while, what I'm doing is exactly what James says in chapter 1, verses 2 through 4, where he says, count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds, for you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness, and let steadfastness have its full effect that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. That's what this partnership with God will do. It's going to provide everything that's needed if we trust in Him and trust without complaining and trust without questioning and all the while understanding what it is I'm becoming. Look at verse 15. That you may be blameless and innocent, children of God without blemish in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation among whom you shine as lights in the world. Look at all of those things we're to become. Blameless, innocent, children of God, lights in the world. What God is saying is, when you work out your own salvation and you trust me and you don't question and you pursue it with ethic and you're fearful and trembling to get it right, that's exactly what's going to happen. You'll be a light in the world. You'll be a child of mine. And I understand that the time in which I'm living, no matter what that time may be, is going to be a challenge for me. Because verse 15 says you live amongst a twisted generation. If ever that could be said, it's now. With people preaching that right is wrong and wrong is right and up is down and down is up and just trying to get us completely discombobulated, not knowing which way to go, that's exactly what the devil wants. But God says, if you work out your own salvation and you understand what you're becoming, the world isn't going to be able to mess you up. You're going to stay straight with it. You're going to understand the need to remain unblemished. Isn't that what James said? Chapter 1, religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their affliction and to keep oneself unstained from the world. When I understand what I'm becoming, a vessel fit for heaven, then sin loses its appeal. Filthiness is something I want to avoid. And what's going on in this twisted world is not something I want to be a part of. Because I understand this can make me blameless, and a child of God, and a light in the world. There's one more thing the apostle tells us. He says, not only is it with fear and trembling and developing that work ethic and doing it without grumbling and questioning and understanding what you're becoming, he says, as I work out my own salvation, I must hold on. And I think it appropriate that as we bring this series to a conclusion, we do it with our next verse here, where he says in verse 16, holding fast to the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I may be proud that I did not run in vain or labor in vain. The word of life is the gospel. And the apostle says this gospel that has the power to save you is the same gospel that will show you how to work out your salvation and on which you must hang. Several years ago, my family and I took a trip out west. And one of the places we visited was Zion National Park. And if you've ever been there, if you're like us, you just fell in love with it. But there is a very treacherous part of that park called Angel's Landing. And somewhat without putting a lot of thought into it, I agreed and climbed up this high, high mountain that just towered above the canyon floor. And all along the way, there were these signs. And this is what the signs read. Since 2004, 6 people have died from falling the cliffs on this route. Goes on to say, the 1.1 mile round trip route from Scout Lookout to Angel's Landing is a strenuous climb on a narrow ridge over 1,400 feet above the canyon floor. This route is not recommended during high winds, storms, or if snow or ice is present. When I start reading about people dying, I pay attention. And that's what this sign was saying. Here was the view from that trail. Certain death. But let me tell you about something I saw on that trail. Because what I don't have in the picture here is a rail that separated the trail from the dangerous part. On the other side of the rail, as I and the boys walked up, there was a man standing out on one of the boulders overlooking this drop-off on the wrong side of the rail, doing yoga. I'm going to tell you there was a striking contrast because I was holding fast to the trail. There was no, I didn't even get close to the rail. You know, I was as far back as I could get. I'm going to tell you it would have been sad if that sign had to be changed for that man. If he had fallen. But there would have been no excuse. He was warned. Examples were given to him. Instructions were stating, don't do this. And I'm going to tell you this. If we don't hold fast to the gospel, I have no excuse. If the gospel does not live in me, when the time of judgment comes and I stand before the Lord, I'll have no excuse to offer. Because He gave me the way. He showed me how to live. And He said, if you will stay true, if you will hold fast to the trail, I'm going to get you exactly where you want to be. And that's why the gospel must live in me. Thus, as we think about all of these ideas, we have determined that the gospel is the power to salvation. We understand we're unworthy of this gift. None of us deserves to be saved. But when belief and faith work together to bring us to baptism, to be immersed in the waters of baptism, God is saying, though you are unworthy, I am remitting those sins, and you are regenerated to live a new life for me. And thus I understand that I must obey that gospel for salvation. But then I must also understand that I've got to live in a worthy manner. And this is what gives lots of people lots of trouble. People say, I'm not perfect. No, none of us are, but that's not an excuse. People say, I just can't do it. And that is true if you approach it from the standpoint of just I. But if God is working in partnership with you, and you're allowing Him to be the leading partner in this, God has said, I promise you, you will be saved. So why would we ever turn that down? So this morning, if I'm speaking to you and you're hearing these words and you're looking at what the Lord has said, and you understand, I need to obey the gospel. Now is the time. Don't put it off any longer. And if you've obeyed that gospel, but you have not lived as a worthy citizen, it's time to get back on the trail. It's time to hold fast. And if we can pray with you about problems you're having, if there's a sin that we can go with you to the throne room of heaven to request that forgiveness, we'll do it. Whatever it takes this morning, let's allow that power of the gospel to be seen in us.